It's really with great pleasure I introduce our last keynote speaker of the annual meeting of ISPSO now in 2012, Ross Lazar. And I'd just like to have some comments about that Ross has been for many, many years a very dear friend. A friendship that has been consisted through many years and different periods of our lives and our families. But on this occasion, however, I will introduce you as a well-known member of the ISPSO. He is a Tavistock-trained psychoanalytic childhood and adolescent psychotherapist, and he also works with adults, couples, and families. He is working as a consultant and supervisor to many organizations, mainly in Germany and Austria. Ross has introduced infant observation in Germany, and as many of you know, he has also applied the method to observation of organizations. You have had workshops on this also in the frame of the ISPSO annual meetings. Ross has also been dedicated to introduce Tavistock group relation work in German-speaking Europe. He has, among others, also been director on two important conferences working with the dilemmas of the two German psychoanalytic associations. And I have had the challenge and the privilege to work with you, Ross, on these two occasions. The last was now in fall 2011. I really admire your courage and your sensitivity when you approach difficult tasks. Finally, I'm referring to one of our talks, conversations we had in preparing this session. And you told me that very early in your life, you made a decision and put a promise to yourself. You would like to work with people from the cradle to the grave. Your paper presentation will give us all a glimpse of your courage and your sensitivity and your ability to link experiences and reflections to theory like an artist. Welcome.
Well, that makes it even more difficult to start. And now, as they say, can you hear me okay? For something completely different. But before I start, a few other preliminary remarks. This is not about Wall Street investment banking. This is not about high-tech military commando structures and strike forces. Instead, I'm going to take you to hospital wards, palliative care clinics, the operating theater, hospice, and even briefly to a graveyard. It is a great, great privilege and honor for me to have been selected by Amy and the committee to speak to you this morning in this beautiful setting, even though my subject is something rather less than beautiful. It was Amy's idea in the first place after I gave a version of this paper in London at the Opus meeting that it would be suitable as the closing keynote for this symposium, and I'm very grateful to her for that, and also to my colleagues Mark Stein and Renate Bugger and Friedrich Wilhelm Lindemann in Berlin for their professional help, their encouragement, and critical support in its preparation. Also deeply felt thanks go to my two co-authors, Dr. Rainer Oechslin and Frau Kirsten Jorgensen, for their generosity in sharing their story with us. And last but not least, to Mrs. Smith, whose sad and moving story you will hear later. And since we're fortunate enough to be meeting here in Southern California, I have two special greetings. Excuse me. One to my oldest friend from kindergarten, Steve Simon, from Teaneck, New Jersey. But most of all, to my mother, who at 95 and a half is alive and well and here, well as can be expected. And it's to her that I dedicate this presentation. At first, I thought no way would this presentation fit into all that has been portrayed and discussed at this symposium in the last few days. But lo and behold, as usual in our meetings, there are many, many links to be made and themes to be taken up. And I'm sure many others will occur to you, but I just want to mention just a very few from the meetings that I've attended. One is the impossibility of truly knowing anyone, which is something that Jim Kranz talked about in his presentation. The other, the need for some transcendent level of whatever that is, which was echoed both in Ed Shapiro's presentation and in Debbie and Byron's work. And last but not least, the theme of death itself, as echoed in Susan Kahn's research project report about a dying institution. Live like you are dying, go the lyrics of a song by Tim McGraw, and which could also serve as a subtitle for what follows. Or, as Steve Jobs reminded us in his famous Stanford University commencement address of 2005, live every day as if it were your last, because someday you will be right. Jobs, of course, was more right about that than he cared to be at the time. In terms of the theme of the symposium, one could say that the ultimate risk to creativity and life is death itself. But one could equally claim that death presents no risk at all. Rather, it remains the only certainty we have, since by now so many people have been able to eliminate taxes. But when? Where? How? Under what circumstances? Can we deal with it? Can we deal with it creatively? Can we deal with it at all? These are the questions that plague us when faced with our own mortality, with our fear of suffering and pain, and the uncertainty of when and how death will finally strike. With these thoughts in mind, let me tell you two stories of life and death, prefaced by Bion's musings on faith in O. And you have to excuse the fact that I'm going to have to read this, because it's just too dense to just tell. At least I can't do it any other way. Bion's faith in O, dealing with the indeterminacy of dying and death. Bion's ideas about faith in O leading to becoming O, that is, approaching an existent but ultimately never to be experienced, never realized, indeed never realizable, ultimate truth, will be elucidated and brought into conjunction with the case material. Although Bion's ideas in this respect have been seen by some as something akin to madness and have been criticized as being nothing but pseudo-spiritual, mystifying, anti-scientific humbug, to my mind they prove to be an effective, realistic, and even scientific tool, as Bion himself claims, for bearing the pain and the fear, for dealing with the uncertainties and vicissitudes of dying and death. Based on the one hand on an example of a psychoanalytically informed approach to the terminal care of a 50-year-old cancer patient, as well as the simultaneous supervision consultation of the hospital team concerned, and on the other, the psychotherapeutic support of a man whose dying wife was first confined to a palliative care unit and then removed to a hospice. I would like to demonstrate the relevance of Bien's notions to this difficult, exhausting, yet moving work. My starting point for these remarks is to be found in my Munich colleague Eckhard Frick's inaugural lecture on the occasion of his being appointed to the professorship of a newly endowed chair for spiritual care at the University of Munich's Medical School in December 2010. This was really a very revolutionary step that the university took. It's an endowed chair, and he's a Jesuit priest and a psychoanalyst, a Jungian, and a psychiatrist, and was given this honor. And to commemorate that, he set up a conference given, which he gave the title Psychoanalysis and Palliative Care in March 2011, and asked me if I would speak exactly to this topic. I must credit him. The idea for this talk was his, not mine. I quote from his final remarks, quote, "It was the psychoanalyst W.R. Bien who took the biggest step forward by suggesting a kind of mysticism of that which is missing, the transcendental O. With this abbreviation, he means to denote the unknown and unknowable beyond our borders." End of quote. With this statement, Frick indicates what he associates with Bien's faith in O and its potential relevance to my examples. Far from being some mystical esoteric mumbo-jumbo or pseudo-religious comfort talk, it is Frick's and my belief that faith in O is ultimately just what the doctor ordered for those of us confronted with dying patients and those affected by them, whether in role as professionals, close relatives, or good friends. In the course of his work, Bien offers us many different formulations, images, adumbrations, as he likes to call them, and circumscriptions of that which he is trying to express with the formulations O and faith in O. Although Bien again and again claims these terms to be what he refers to as scientific, still he avoids even attempting to give us anything like any definitive definitions. It is for this reason, among others, that I have allowed myself to refer to other sources, theological, religious, aesthetic ones, in addition to several relevant quotes from Bien's writings, as it is from these sources that his ideas stem. Each of these, in its way, gives us an inkling of what Bien is referring to when he speaks of O. The Brazilian psychoanalyst Paulo Cesar Sandler, author of a voluminous dictionary of Bien's work, helps us to deal with this ultimately indefinable material by collecting and commenting on its various sources. For instance, Sandler emphasizes that faith in O is always meant to denote, quote, a scientific state of mind, unquote, not, as I already mentioned, anything esoteric or pseudo-mystical. In his book, Attention and Interpretation, Bien writes, quote, O stands for the absolute truth in and of any object. It is assumed that this cannot be known by any human being. Its presence can be recognized and felt, but it cannot be known. It is, however, possible to be at one with it. And further, that it exists is an essential postulate of science, but it cannot be scientifically discovered. No psychoanalytic discovery is possible without recognition of its existence, at one-ment with it, and evolution. What I believe Bien means here by an essential postulate of science, I will return to in a minute. But let us first get some more of his statements on the table in order to try and outline, as it were, although it is ultimately unbounded, what he wants to call our attention to. Bien goes on to link faith in O to certain traditions of religious mysticism, while emphasizing that it has nothing to do with religious faith in its commonly used sense. Quote, "The religious mystics have probably approximated most closely to expression of experience of it. Its existence is as essential to science as to religion. Conversely, the scientific approach is as essential to religion as it is to science. Unquote. So what are we to think now? On the one hand, a scientific state of mind. On the other, something best apprehended by religious mystics. But again, let us beware. Beyond O, as I said, ultimately has little or nothing to do with the religious meaning of the word faith, as we know it theologically. He elaborates this point as follows, quote, "An act of faith is peculiar to scientific procedure and must be distinguished from the religious meaning with which it is invested in conversational usage. It becomes apprehensible when it can be represented in and by thought. It must evolve before it can be apprehended, and it is apprehended when it is a thought, just as the artist's O is apprehensible when it has been transformed into a work of art." So, by now, entitled to being completely confounded, we summarize his statements thus. A scientific concept, non-religious, although best apprehended by religious mystics, and now the source of the artist's inspiration. And if that isn't enough, Bion assures us that for him, and as he claims for us as well, faith in O is the preferred state of mind for us as psychoanalysts and psychoanalytic consultants. Now let's take this one step at a time. We begin with the religious mystics. It is well known that Bion was generally not interested in religion in the traditional sense, and was indeed very critical of the Anglican Church as an institution. Having suffered from its influence in childhood, he lambasted it for its snobbish, dishonest, upper-middle-class attitudes. Still, these early and very negative experiences with organized religion didn't stop him, perhaps even inspired him, to study the thinking and writing of Jewish as well as Christian mystics in depth. In addition, many have remarked that his ideas so closely resemble much Eastern religious thought, primarily Zen Buddhism, and which people often try to link to his childhood in India and his Indian ayah, his nanny, who cared for him until he was 8 years old when he was sent off to boarding school at Bishop Stortford. It is possible, of course, perhaps even likely, that he drank in some of the spirit of Asian thought unconsciously in those formative years. But to my knowledge, and if anyone knows otherwise, I'd be happy to be corrected, but to my knowledge, he himself never mentioned any such reference as it being related to his early life whatsoever. So relevant and logical as that association may seem to us, whether there is ultimately any truth in it must remain a matter of speculation. According to Paulo Sandler, Bion's concept of faith in O evolved on the one hand from the Jewish scholar and mystic Isaac Luria, and on the other from the Meditations of St. John of the Cross, mainly derived from his lyric volume, The Dark Night. In these poems, St. John of the Cross describes a mentality characterized by what he referred to as deprivation. Bion's famous dictum, "Without memory, desire, and understanding," stems from this thought. St. John writes, I quote, "A soul very much hinders its elevation to this sublime state of unison with God if it holds on to any kind of understanding, of feeling, or imagining, or thinking, or wanting in its own way to any other work or thing belonging to him, her, because it cannot completely free itself of it. For as I said, that which it strives for is well above all this, even above the most sublime which might be acknowledged or experienced. The soul should therefore remain empty, like a blind man supported by the dark faith, guided by it and illuminated, but not supported by something which the soul understands, tastes, feels, and imagines. For all this is misleading darkness, and faith is above all understanding, savoring, feeling, and imagining. End of quote. Essential learning about the impossibility of expressing the essence of things also came from Rabbi Luria, whom Bion often quoted. Bion tells the story of Luria, who, when asked by one of his pupils why he had never written down any of his teachings in books, replied, quote, "This is not possible, since everything is linked. The minute I open my mouth in order to say things, it seems to me that the dams of the ocean open up and flood everything. So how can I say what my soul received, and how should I write it down in a book?" End of quote. But let us leave the mystics at this point and turn to what Bion calls the scientific aspect. Paulo Sandler calls the symbol O a quasi-mathematical notation symbolizing the numinous area of non-sensuous experience, which is exactly what St. John of the Cross was just describing, non-sensuous experience, or Kant's thing in itself, and links it up with Plato's ideal forms. Again, he quotes Bion saying that O and faith in O are an essential postulate of science, albeit not to be explained by scientific means. Its existence, as he said, is just as essential to science as it is to religion. To what does this refer? To my mind, this means that Bion, along with other Neoplatonists, is convinced that there is a layer of ultimate existence beyond any and all worldly manifestations of phenomena, be they material or non-material, physical or psychic. Therefore, neither science as we ordinarily are accustomed to thinking of it, nor religion in the usual theological sense, can possibly exist apart from it. The third of the three vertices or points of view that Bion refers to in approaching O is the one I feel I understand best, the one which I refer to as the aesthetic aspect. The inspiration, the experience of a perception felt by artists like Claude or Turner, or Van Gogh, Cézanne, or Renoir, before being able to paint their miraculous landscapes, can, like the actuality of a dream proper, never really be experienced by another person. The painting painted by the artist, the poem written by the poet, or the music composed by the composer, or the dreams dreamt by all of us, and we just had a wonderful example of this where Nuala then actually painted her dreams for us in her presentation. All of these are derivatives of that unique experience of O, which the artist first apprehends and then expresses in his medium in the form he gives it. Bion claims that in every moment of a psychoanalytic encounter, indeed in every moment of life, there is an O, an ultimate truth, which we may seek to approach, knowing full well that although it can never be reached, we can open ourselves towards becoming it, a notion similar to Bion's quotation of John Keats' idea of negative capability. Now, keeping all that in the backs of our minds, let us move on to my first case history, albeit with a word of warning. To me, the fates of the people involved in the two cases which follow are so painful and moving as to bring tears to my eyes every time. I hope for your sympathy and understanding in this regard. The patient who could neither live nor die. Leave is good, she couldn't leave. An experienced hospital team at the brink of the unbearable. Several years ago, and long before I had been able to gather much experience, not to mention expertise as a consultant, I was contacted by a local clinic with a most unusual request for help. Since I was known to both the clinic director and one of his most experienced and trusted head nurses, and as I had occasionally been asked to do consultations there in my role as psychotherapist, my work as supervisor and consultant to organizations, rudimentary as it was at the time, was also not unknown to them. Nevertheless, I was most surprised when another nurse, head of a different ward, and someone until then unknown to me, asked for my aid in dealing with an extremely difficult, seemingly insoluble problem. The patient, her illness, and the treatment. A few weeks earlier, a middle-aged woman had been admitted to the ward for post-treatment care of her incurable cancer. The admission was specified as being for an indefinite period of time. This is very unusual because this is a clinic that treats people. It's not a hospice. It's not palliative care. It's not an end. You know, it treats people. And this lady was untreatable. And yet it was, because it's a private place, arrangements had been made that she could stay there. Mrs. Smith was an unmarried woman in her mid-50s who originally came from Scotland. She had been employed as head of an accounting department for a large foreign company and was, as far as the clinic knew, a loner, having no close friends or relatives at all in Germany. She had undergone abdominal cancer surgery the previous winter, followed by radiation treatments at the highest dosage tolerable, mainly because of the fact that the tumor was so large and in such an awkward position that it had proved impossible to remove it completely. The consequences of this rather unsuccessful treatment were devastating both for the patient as well as for the clinic team. At this point, let me again quote from Eckhart Frick's inaugural lecture. Employing the formula life equals body plus X, Frick says, the acceptance of X runs in accordance with the acceptance of one's own methodological and theoretical limits, especially when the limits of treatment have been reached. Then all depends on how the person, doctor or patient, deals with these limits and their insurmountability. In the case of Mrs. Smith, the limits of treatability had long been reached and surpassed. What to do now was a question for which no one at the time had an answer. Mrs. Smith suffered from excruciating pain, which remained resistant to treatment by any of the many and varied means of the university's best pain specialists. They had tried everything in their power to relieve her from her suffering, to no avail. In spite of incredibly large doses of morphine, sleeping pills, and other medication, she suffered at times, but only at times, from this unbearable pain. The prognosis seemed hopeless, yet death as the only possible relief from this torture was as yet unforeseeable. Living on in this condition was seen as being unacceptable and unbearable for all, but there was no acute medical aspect of her condition which would cause her death in the foreseeable future. There were no further metastases, and she was otherwise surprisingly awake and robust. She had a good appetite and sometimes even showed humor in spite of her incredible pain and the high doses of medication which she was given in the attempt to combat it. At times, though, as some nurses complained, she could be absolutely obnoxious towards certain members of the ward staff. She would order them around, in spite, or rather because, of her helplessness, to the extent that even some of the most experienced nurses began to refuse to care for her or even enter her room. Especially aggravating was her incredible ability to set them off against one another, dividing them hierarchically into those who were allowed the privilege of taking care of her, washing her, massaging her, etc., and those who were not. She stirred up enormous rivalry, competition, and hatred amongst this otherwise highly professional, highly trained, and highly experienced staff. Besides this, she seemed completely unaware of her true condition, to the extent that it was impossible to get her to cooperate with the nursing staff's attempts to care for her properly. On the contrary, she denied her condition to such a degree that doctors and nurses felt incapable of telling her the truth being that given the progress of the cancer and the damage done by the radiation treatments, she couldn't possibly survive. But neither could she die. No end to her torture was in sight. It was not until some time later that I was given a piece of information which turned out to be crucial to the understanding, if I can call it that, of her psychodynamics. But as I didn't know it at the time, I shall keep you also in the dark for it for now. The worst task of all, with which the nurses were continually confronted, was the treatment of Mrs. S.'s open wound. Merely talking about it even caused one colleague to faint. The amount of unbearable uncontainableness overwhelmed the team and made it so helpless that it was rendered partially incapable of fulfilling its tasks for this patient, as it was used to doing with extraordinary diligence and dedication for all the other patients in their care. The team members themselves were exhausted. None felt in a position to do Mrs. Smith justice. They could neither tend to her physical needs nor to her psychological ones. There was nowhere to send her, neither to a different hospital, to a nursing home, nor could they send her home altogether. They clashed permanently and inextricably with one another, and was neither a medical nor any other kind of solution to the problem in sight. All they could agree upon was that something new and unconventional was needed. Otherwise, both they and Mrs. Smith were hopelessly stuck. In their despair, the two head nurses and the ward physician came up with the unusual, for them almost absurd, idea to look for an outside person who was psychologically trained and able to talk to the patient in English, her mother tongue, as well as being able to offer a kind of supervision to the team in charge of the patient's care. Since I had experience in both areas, still speak some English, and was well known. I like it when people say, oh, you speak very good English. Where do you come from? I don't know myself at this point. And since I was well known and trusted by some of the staff and the clinic's director, they asked me to take on this most unusual double task. I myself was overwhelmed and shocked by the patient's fate, as well as by the state the team was in, and was, I admit, quite frightened to become involved in this seemingly hopeless, futile situation at all. I really felt like, don't touch it, just let it pass. Supervising the team at the same time as treating the patient seemed, in addition, a nearly insurmountable hurdle. As difficult and confusing as the overlapping of roles and drawing of boundaries was certain to be, still, one could argue that there was a different, compelling logic to the situation. Somehow, someone had to attempt to keep everything together, since at the moment, all concerned were either in fight-flight or in denial. A container of sorts for the whole situation was what they were looking for, and indeed was that which was desperately needed. But could I, should I, or moreover, would I be capable of offering and sustaining such containment for as much and as long as might be required? In the end, and after much consultation with colleagues and trusted other professionals, I decided I must give it a try. Talking with the patient herself proved to be both fascinating and exhausting. We had agreed that I would come to see her twice a week for an hour, as long as she felt capable of it and wished to see me. Our meetings were at times very touching, sometimes even cheerful, at other times filled with deep sadness or great anger. In none of my therapeutic work so far have I ever focused as much on treating the patient authentically as Frick describes it. It was, in fact, about a kind of communal not knowing, about the absurdity of her suffering and about the inevitability of death. One episode from this treatment, or should I rather say encounter, shall serve to illustrate something of the atmosphere between us in the room. I've called this the spring conversation. Riding my bicycle to the third or fourth visit with the patient one morning, the clinic is right near where I live, I was enchanted by the beauty of the fading winter and the tender first signs of approaching spring. Although there was still some snow on the ground, the air was already warmed by the sun, the birds were twittering in the young greenness of the trees. It was a day made for enjoyment, the celebration of life. But I had to go see the patient, had to enter into what for me had become a chamber of death. I had to be in that room filled with the acrid smell of medicines, cleaning chemicals, and sweat, and worst of all, reeking with the deathly stench of the suffering patient's necrotic wound. Mrs. Smith was a large, buxom woman whose pale, freckled complexion and reddish hair gave an inkling of her Scottish origins. Her broad Scottish lilt, when she spoke at all, confirmed this. She was clad in a smock-like nightgown, and as she perspired nearly constantly, this unbecoming garment was drenched in sweat, as was her long, sparse hair. Her features were rather coarse, and her long and awful suffering was written on her face. All in all, a most unattractive scene, calling forth strong feelings, both of revulsion and of pity. When I entered the room, Mrs. S. was lying on her side as usual, facing towards the interior of the room, that is, not towards the window. She greeted me in a grumpy tone. How was she today? Unchanged. How was she finding the nursing care? It varies, she grunted. Some nurses are charming, others are witches. Some can cream and massage me beautifully. Others torture and mistreat me on purpose. They even seem to be enjoying it. I didn't know it at the time, but as it turned out, in the evidence which I will tell you from the meetings with the nurses, how right she was about this. Quite discouraged and somewhat desperate, with not an idea in my head, and feeling rather depressed myself, I took up my usual position on the side of her bed, nearest the window, and remained silent for a while. So did Mrs. S. It was completely quiet, except for the birds in the trees outside, and I felt the warmth of the sun on my back shining through the open window. Wanting to try to say something, I inquired, had she noticed the beginning of spring? She turned towards me and towards the window, listening, smelling a little of the spring air, and asked me how it felt outside. I described the atmosphere outdoors, the lingering snow, the tender green of the trees and plants, the birds twittering, the warmth of the sun. She listened intently and became more awake, friendlier, livelier, and more responsive. It seemed as if we were able at this moment to get a little closer to that bit of vitality and joy of living still inside her, with a trace of spring feelings, awakened by the weather and atmosphere, which in a way I had imported into this chamber of death from outside. But in the main, it seemed clear to me that it was, dare I say, the O of nature itself, which being able to be not only smelled and heard and felt, but somehow experienced at another level, that brought on this faint new whiff of vitality. Still, we both knew that the patient could experience this pleasure only from her bed, and that the likelihood of her experiencing spring feelings again the next year were probably quite nil. Quietly and gently, we said goodbye to each other, and it seemed to me for the first and only time that the patient had found some peace and contentment in my presence, and that through this, perhaps, she might be in a better position to realize and accept her fate, whatever it was to be. After a few more visits, I found the patient mostly either dozing or sometimes even sound asleep. When awake, she either ignored me completely or seemed to be hardly aware of my presence. Finally, she told the nurses to tell me not to come any longer. I never saw her again. About 2 months later, she died. In retrospect, I would claim that I entered into this adventure naively, entertaining neither goals nor intentions. For sure, I was very frightened of what I might encounter, but neither had I any concrete expectations nor any idea of what might ensue. In this sense, it was quite easy for me to be without memory. I had nothing to remember, without desire, for I didn't know what to wish for, except perhaps that the patient be freed of her pain and suffering, and without understanding, because it was quite clear to me that I understood practically nothing, at least to begin with, of what was going on in and with this patient, nor in the situation as a whole. Only much later did it occur to me that ultimately this encounter was really all about approaching O in the bionic sense. That is to say, it was about the patients and my existence in the moment as such and nothing else. In retrospect, I feel more able to link the experience with Mrs. Smith, both with Bion's notion that the idea of becoming O is a scientific one as well as a transcendental one. But this is an area which certainly calls for further exploration and more rigorous examination and discussion. I'll now move on to the team sessions. In the sessions with the team, the sessions with the team proved to be as fascinating as they were difficult. They were tense and absorbing in a way that no other work I had ever been involved in before had ever been, but also more strenuous, more painful, and more intense. The ensuing debate about death and life was more radical, more honest, and more concrete than I ever could have imagined beforehand. These meetings took place once a week and, for technical reasons, were to be held immediately after my session with the patient. Since there was no other room available, we had to meet in the ward's public lounge. For the period of our meetings, we could be more or less undisturbed there, but optically we were on show, since the walls of the room were of glass. It's a modern building, and this room represents a conservatory with a balcony. Also, everyone involved had a different schedule and different duties. Thus, there was an unavoidable and continuous coming and going, not exactly what you would call a well-contained setting. 10 to 15 nurses and caregivers participated each time. The ward physician attended as much as she could, some other doctors and nurses from other wards, and a few young men who were doing community service as an alternative to military service. Perhaps to becoming SEALs, but I think they preferred to work in a hospital. One of the most important figures in attendance was the patient's physiotherapist. Looking at the external circumstances, the setting was a disaster, but I soon realized that again, I had to accommodate myself to the system as given and try to make the best of the situation. Bion liked to call this making the best of a bad job. In this case, I could see no alternative. The first session got off to a rough start. Much displeasure about the patient was voiced. Conflict within the team regarding her care became evident, as well as much skepticism about the idea of supervision itself. Indeed, some of the nurses expressed their extreme doubts about what we were attempting to undertake. They simply couldn't imagine there being any real help to be had by just talking with me. Under the surface, much anger, enormous helplessness, extreme pessimism, and paralyzing depression were evident. It was clear that through this patient, the staff members' identity, their understanding of their own roles, even their belief in medicine and their own ability to act in a professional way to influence a given state of affairs, had existential doubt cast upon it. An older colleague expressed everyone's utter helplessness with the following words. "You know," she told me adamantly, "we are used to tending to our patients, to caring for them properly, and this we know how to do and do well. Some patients we care for until they're well again. Others we care for and accompany until they die. This is what we are here to do, what we are used to doing, and what we are good at. But with Mrs. S., this has proved impossible, and that makes us feel so completely helpless and despondent." Blame and accusations of failure were addressed partly towards the medical staff and partly towards the nurses themselves. "Give her even more painkillers," was the one cry. "No, get her to be more active herself," the physiotherapist demanded. "We must expect more of her," said one nurse. "No, it's impossible. I can't take any more of this myself," replied the next. Some avoided confrontations with the patient and with their own anxiety as best they could. Others declared openly that they were at the end of their tether and that they refused to have anything whatsoever to do with the patient's care. All felt immensely guilty towards this poor woman and her suffering, whom they could in no way relieve of her misery, and about their own hateful feelings towards her, related to their own feelings of failure as competent professionals. Applying Bien's basic assumptions to this situation, the group without the supervisor was clearly in basic assumption fight flight. Left to their own devices with their anxieties, feelings of helplessness, their frustration and anger, some could think of nothing but fight solutions, while others could only imagine fleeing from the situation altogether. Together with the supervisor, the group's basic assumption changed to that of dependency. Under the circumstances, it was no wonder that they had exaggerated and excessive demands and expectations on me to produce the solution to this insoluble dilemma. The assumption that the patient herself was somehow guilty of her condition and fate, since she had known about her tumor for over a year, this is the bit that I didn't know before, but had done nothing about it, seeking treatment for it at the time, and the fact that her mother had died of exactly the same illness some years before, only made the situation worse. But admitting to having such feelings was nearly unimaginable for all concerned, as their professional training, their institutional and group culture, and their professional ethics had always preached them the opposite. Nevertheless, such unspoken, such forbidden feelings became more and more evident in the myriad transference and countertransference feelings which began to emerge in our sessions together. Eventually, I felt able to begin to name some of them. The first opportunity arose at the end of the second team session. When at the beginning of this session, I rather naively asked whether they thought the patient was moving more in the direction of life or more towards death, emotions broke out, especially amongst those nurses who had been most rejecting of the patient. Much to my and probably everyone's surprise, they openly and nearly unanimously admitted hoping that the patient would soon die. This caused great consternation amongst the others, because hearing this said openly in public, rather than in the secure anonymity of a conversation on the ward, was shocking and upsetting to all. The next session, the third one, began in a totally depressed atmosphere. The situation was described as more desperate than ever. The patient didn't sleep. Instead, she called for someone every hour throughout the night, demanding to be massaged. She knew exactly which nurses she would allow to tend to her and massage her, and those whom she rejected outright. Such remarks from the patient, knowingly or unknowingly, created increased competition amongst the nurses. They were becoming more and more cross with her for succeeding so well in playing one off against the other, despite this being such an experienced team. She herself, meanwhile, managed as best she could to claim the role of spoiled baby for herself. In the middle of the fifth session, all the negative and destructive, but also the depressive, sad, and anxious feelings, which had still somehow remained hidden up until then, erupted. Finally, the team was able to admit that they did not only wish the patient might die from her illness and soon, but that they had truly murderous fantasies of killing her outright. Some even confessed that they could imagine laying a hand on her, and given the demands of the patient to be massaged continually, this was a very double-edged statement indeed. This general outburst even enabled one person to openly express her very concrete fantasies of actually doing the patient in. Such macabre thoughts and massive feelings of guilt literally tumbled out of the team. But by then all had come to appreciate, at least to a certain extent, the opportunity of expressing their most obscure and forbidden feelings and fantasies in the relatively protected and safe setting of the supervision. And that in that setting, they could make these most secret and forbidden thoughts public and share them with their colleagues, only to discover that they were not alone in having them. Indeed, as my Berlin colleague Friedrich Lindemann pointed out, allowing such murderous fantasies into consciousness and formulating them aloud has the beneficial effect of taking the sting out of them and rendering them less potent for being exposed in public and shared within the group. From this point on, the patient's state deteriorated rapidly. For the first time, she began to feel really ill, and the medication began to have a more positive effect. She slept a lot, and it was finally possible for the team to nurse her to death in calm and quiet dignity. Discussion. In retrospect, this leads one to speculate, perhaps even to hypothesize, that the new and increased frankness regarding the ultimate truth of Mrs. Smith's desperate situation and the position of the hospital staff vis-a-vis her terrible fate opened up the possibility of everyone being in a better position for facing and hence dealing with it, even to the point of creating the conditions under which all could let her go and let Mrs. Smith pass away in peace. But as Renata has kindly pointed out to me, there was a lot missing in my interventions at an organizational level. Had I known then what I know now, I would have certainly questioned the lack of leadership, both of the senior medical as well as the senior nursing staff, to fulfill their duty to work to task by taking responsibility for the organization and containment of their coworkers so as to restore the group's functionality as a work group. But at the time, while being well aware of their dysfunctionality and basic assumption dynamic, I was not clear about their failure to take up their leadership roles in appropriate, courageous, energetic, and containing way, nor of the necessity on the part of myself as the consultant to point this out to them, hopefully with the goal of enabling them to do so. Of course, many questions remain unanswered, many fantasies and feelings unresolved. But the main purpose was achieved. The team could again work successfully and cooperatively together, and the patient was able to die in a humane and dignified way in the caring atmosphere that the team was so good at and so proud of being able to provide. Also, they had neither to live with the guilt of not having done everything possible, nor of having to resort to illegal, immoral means of ridding themselves of the problem. The courage to delve so deeply into one's own soul, to question one's own professional identity, as well as one's relationship to suffering and dying, impressed us all, shattering and deeply moving as the experience was. Neither I nor the other participants did this somehow on purpose, yet everyone had contributed to its happening. The patient's fate had forced it upon us, and the lucky combination of internal and external factors, as much in the team members as in the patient, as well as in the supervisor therapist, and indeed the institution itself, had facilitated the experience of catastrophic change in all of us, bringing us, almost forcing us, as I would suggest, into the immediacy of becoming O, in spite of all the unfavorable external conditions. So what do you think? Is what happened here an example of a group in the process of becoming O? I don't know. Indeed, given its nature, I don't know that we can know, that we can ever know. This is, however, one way in which I at least imagine it. For it seems to me that in our sheer collective helplessness and frustration, and given the fact that nothing of the usual techniques, mechanisms, models, or procedures to deal with such anguish, such anxiety, and such vulnerability proved applicable, led us perhaps, as I say, even forced us into a radically open position of not knowing and of existential preparedness to approach the unknown without prejudice, without preformed conclusions, that is to say, truly, without memory, without desire, and without understanding. Now, that's the end of the first case. I'm watching the time, and I hope you bear with me. The next one is much shorter and much more optimistic. So with your permission, I'll continue. This is called Surely We Won't Surrender to Death, A Tale of Cancer, in which Dr. Rainer Uxlin and his wife Kirsten Jorgensen describe to us a completely different cancer story from the point of view of the persons directly affected. Perhaps I should say a word about how this came about. Dr. Uxlin has been my client for many, many years, talking about completely different things, and in the course of our work, all of a sudden his wife had this terrible diagnosis, also of breast cancer, and I accompanied him through this turmoil and terror that he and his wife then agreed to describe, and so they are the authors of this part. Dr. Erksland begins. It began shortly before Easter 2009. My wife began to have terrible back pains, which simply would not go away. The orthopedic specialist could find nothing, but her condition continued to worsen. Finally, on October 26, she could hardly move. Our family doctor called the radiologist, and the same evening we went in for an MRI. We were then told that her condition was extremely serious. After another MRI 3 days later, the diagnosis was clear: breast cancer at an advanced stage with metastases along the whole of her spine and into her pelvis. "I won't talk about this in terms of shock just now," he writes. "It was just that I was extremely worried about the woman I had married only 1 year previously. I only wish that the treatment begin as soon as possible. But first, the cancer had to be located more precisely. This was to be done in the university hospital. On November 3rd, Kirsten went from one test to the next. By the end of this ordeal, she lay on my coat on the floor, completely exhausted. Back home, we awaited the results. During the night of November 9th, the situation escalated. Kirsten was in such extreme pain that she could stand it no longer. Towards morning, she was ready to go into hospital, a palliative ward run by the Sisters of the Benedictine Mission. I can hardly describe the feeling of coming back to the empty apartment from which they had just carried the most beloved person in my life away. But the senior physician had at least managed to control the pain and the nausea that came with it. In the meantime, the hospital staff had identified the cancer and its terrible toll: a hormone receptor positive cancer, which had already rendered the spine in a dangerous state. Surgery to stabilize it was deemed as being too risky. Therefore, radiation treatments were prescribed to begin with. On November 18th, we moved on to radiation therapy in W. Long waiting hours, Kirsten in a bed in the hallway. Finally, the radiologist came up to me to say that she dared not start the treatment. The lower cervical or upper thoracic vertebrae might collapse further, bringing with it the risk of paraplegia. However, she thought Dr. J in M might possibly be able to help. So I took the x-rays to him. The neurosurgeon looked at the images and said, "Surgery is just about possible, but this has to happen immediately. I'll reserve a bed for tomorrow." I went back to find Kirsten still in the hall, at a loss at my long absence. After a terrible night, an ambulance moved Kirsten to the other hospital on a special stretcher. On November 23rd, Kirsten had surgery. Two vertebrae were removed and replaced by a synthetic plate. While she was being operated on, I had to give a lecture nearby, as I was still just about managing to work. In the evening, I returned to M. The surgery was successful. When Dr. J announced the results, this rational, down-to-earth man had tears in his eyes. But the most difficult period was yet to come. On December 1st, Kirsten was transferred to a special cancer clinic in O. She called me in the evening. "Please come right away. I feel uneasy here." So I went, and there I stayed. Had I known that I would be with her every night for the next 20 weeks, in the end camping in the hospice ward on a camp bed, which I brought up from the basement every night, I might have shied away from it. The psychoanalyst with whom I had been seeing for supervision for years, that is me, and whom I consulted in this crisis, occasionally asked me how much longer I thought I would be able to keep this up. But I knew that my decision to remain by her was the right one. Within 3 weeks, Kirsten was in need of permanent nursing care. She began having nightmares. Because she sensed my coming, she called for me. Then her voice failed. For months, she could only whisper. A catheter became necessary, as well as a morphine drip. December 17th was one of the days I'll never forget. Kirsten had a funny feeling while under radiation therapy. I spoke to the radiologist, who said that my wife might have 30 or 60 or maybe 100 days maximum to live. What should I do? Kirsten was very weak. I had already begun feeding her all her meals some time before. but she was still clear in her mind. I told her about the prognosis, and she began to think about it. Just that day, the regional bishop had come to visit her, for, by the way, and this is a very interesting by the way, we are both Lutheran ministers. The bishop realized the situation and recommended a palliative ward in Munich. And when I told her that I had used up all my holiday time, she added, "You stay with your wife. We'll find a way." In the following weeks, I made full use of her offer. On December 12th, Kirsten made her decision. She explained to the ward physician and to me, "I want to be in a place where I can be without pain, where my husband can stay with me, and where I can take leave of my parents, siblings, and friends in peace." On December 23rd, she was transferred to Munich. Here, Kirsten finally found peace. From the first moment on, she felt the calming atmosphere of the palliative ward. She was taken care of with consideration and love. She felt safe and secure. We shared a large room with two beds. I left Kirsten during those days only when she was being washed. I had already brought in the Herrenhut star, a star made of paper, sometimes lit inside with a little candle, which we hang up in the weeks before and around Christmas, and the little figures of the creche from home. We celebrated Christmas together. Mobilizing all her forces, Kirsten managed even to attend the Christmas Mass in the foyer of the ward. In the following days, her parents and her four siblings came. My father, my siblings, my children, it's a second marriage. Kirsten's friends, amongst them, the minister I had asked in Kirsten's name to conduct the funeral for her. On January 5th, I bought a grave near our house. This is the tough part. Kirsten wanted to know where she would be put to rest. On January 6th, her parents came for a second time. After that, the visitors program was finished. But Kirsten didn't die. Instead, she asked me to wheel her, complete with her oxygen mask, through the snowy park of the nearby palace grounds. This was the beginning of a strange period. From mid-January on, I felt that Kirsten was getting stronger little by little. The change was minimal, but being with someone 24 hours a day, one recognizes even the smallest changes. When I told the medical staff about my observations, the doctors and nurses just shook their heads. Whereas I was counting on Kirsten to live another few weeks or months or, God willing, even longer, as I wrote in a mail to family and friends, they were waiting for her to die. A palliative ward, of course, has no provision for long-stay patients, not to mention patients who recover. They are intended for people who come there to die in peace, because according to medical opinion, they have no chance of surviving. And this is now me speaking, putting it a bit ironically, the primary task of the patient in the palliative care ward, or indeed even more so in a hospice, is to die, preferably comfortably and in peace. If the patient doesn't, then he's just off task. But what if the page turns? For instance, it was my wife's wish to have physiotherapy because her mother's muscles had become very weak from being confined to her bed for so long. We found the doctors and nurses' reaction shattering. "What does she need physiotherapy for?" remarked one nurse airily. "For what she has to deal with, she has muscle enough. And besides, how nice it is to be surrounded by such pleasant fragrances when so shortly before dying." Kirsten and I decided that should she survive, we would create a cabaret show out of these experiences. We realized that our views and theirs were diametrically opposed. The palliative ward expected her to survive only a short time, while we were ready to fight for her survival, grasping at any hopeful sign. And yet Kirsten still felt very comfortable on this ward, and at her request she was allowed to stay there much longer than usual. 5 weeks later, on January 28th, she was transferred to the hospice, a terrible day for me. The word hospice sounded so hopeless, And in addition, there now somehow seemed to be no room for me at all anymore. The room was big, but with provisions for one person only. On the evening of January 29th, the oncologist, who would be taking care of us from now on, arrived. He announced, "The pain treatment is okay, but why aren't they combating the illness itself? Let's start again, fighting the cancer and stabilizing the bones. Maybe we'll get you out of bed again." What now follows is a different story altogether. On April 19th, Kirsten was able to leave the hospice and return home. Until the beginning of July, when we went out, she sat in a wheelchair. Since then, she began walking without any help. She's taken up driving again and leads a largely independent life. For a long time now, the results of her blood tests have been those of a healthy person. The oncologist has now begun to talk of her condition as one of seriological complete remission. With this, says Dr. Erickson, he ends his part of the story. The last words in this tale belong to Kirsten Jorgensen herself. Looking back on the past year, she formulated the following, quote, "I believe that both life and death lies in God's hands. I am very grateful for the fact that I not only knew, but also felt this at every moment. For through this, I was able to accept my destiny. At the same time, there was one part of me not yet ready to leave. My husband reports hearing me once say to a friend, 'Surely we're not going to surrender to death.' In the middle of this fight for survival, instinctively, I looked for allies. There was the feeling of security in the palliative ward and the hospice, with everything my husband has already described. There was the support of the psychotherapist who regularly came to see me. This was someone else, not me. There were my many family and friends, but the largest and most immediate part in this positive development was due to my husband, first and last. Through weeks and months, day and night, he hardly ever left me alone, not even for an hour. Every time I was parked in some strange bed in some hall, he sat next to me and read to me, even in the days when I found myself already somewhere between heaven and earth. I always felt that he was near and shared my fate. We both know that this form of accompaniment is unusual, but only in this way could what many might be inclined to call a miracle of healing take place. For Frau Jorgensen, and surely for many others, this can, of course, be understood in terms of religious belief and experience in the narrower, more theological sense. My claim with Bian is that there is an even more basic existential level at which it transpires, which cannot be thought about, cannot be named, and cannot be understood, even in more usual spiritual terms, but must be become, as Bian calls it. So much for Rainer Erickson's and Kirsten Jorgensen's telling of their tale of cancer. My role in this drama of life and death was confined to listening to Dr. Erickson share with me the latest developments in those occasional sessions we were able to squeeze in when he could get away from his wife's side for an hour or so. Even at second hand, the story of his and his wife's bravery, stamina, and faith in life, if I may call it that, was so moving, so harrowing, that I felt existentially involved in it. Often we were both simply moved to tears of sadness, of anger, sometimes of desperation, occasionally even of joy. It is this feeling of being indirectly, but somehow even directly involved in, of being witness to, this life and death struggle that led me to conceive of it in terms of Bian's becoming O. The emotional immediacy of Dr. Erickson's words of his presence in my consulting room seemed to put us in touch not only with his wife's and his own personal suffering, but with something universal, something unfathomable, something beyond the facts, beyond even the directly felt emotional experiences. Might we not refer to this as becoming our? But why, I was asked when presenting this paper at the Opus meeting in November last year, why do you need to apply such a difficult, unpin-downable notion such as becoming O to this work? Why doesn't it suffice to use the customary ideas about splitting, projection, idealization, projective identification, and so on, which is our common parlance, and which in the main do us very well in our work with even severely ill, traumatized, and otherwise damaged personalities? This question posed, by the way, at the Opus meeting by Mark Stein, and which I found extremely provocative and stimulating, made me think, why indeed? What is the added value of approaching such phenomenon from such a vertex? My short answer is, because the notions mentioned which we employ in our everyday work are simply not sufficient. They do not reach far enough into the unknown, the unfathomable and terrifying depths of that which attains to the nearness and dying of death. Again, not wanting to sound esoteric or mystical, it seems to me that given that much proximity to death itself, one enters a realm in which conventional wisdom, even of the most erudite sort, just isn't enough. Bion would presumably even argue that this is true even in the most mundane situations, settings, and sessions, and that may well be the case. But it was only through doing this work that I realized that there was so much more to what was going on than such ordinary concepts could contain. For as Neville and Joan Symington stated, Bion's starting point is completely different from that of Freud's or Klein's. Rather than hypothesizing that psychic life begins from a raw mass of instinctive impulses, Bion's conviction is that it stems from an ultimate and unknowable origin. Of course, this work was not carried out in anything like a psychoanalytic setting in the narrow sense, but in settings in which, nevertheless, becoming O became not only possible, but existentially necessary. Needless to say, the expectations neither of the nursing staff in the clinic where Mrs. S. was treated, nor in the palliative care ward and hospice where Kirsten Jorgensen was treated, were accustomed to, nor were they prepared for such a confrontation. On the contrary, they found themselves unwittingly confronted with the dilemma that Bion claims we all have to have when faced with our mortal fate. We hate it and do our best to try to avoid realizing it. But faith in O, he claims, reveals and makes possible experiences that are often painful and difficult for the individual and the group to tolerate. Just because such phrases as becoming real, becoming what one is, becoming oneself one's own truth, have in part been hijacked by the myriad of would-be witches and wizards of esotericism, doesn't mean that their relevance, that their truth has been diminished in any way. Introducing such a transcendent level into our work with individuals, groups, and institutions can be seen and felt as a rather daring and often unwelcome undertaking, a threat to some, an invitation and challenge to others to take a creative leap, a risk into the unknown. One can only have faith that its benefits outweigh its liabilities, especially when confronted with the ultimate reality of death. Living one's life in the shadow of impending death is, as we have seen with these two case examples, a risky business. Living that life creatively and to the fullest, the vital challenge which faces us all, the risk of failure is high. Bion inspires us as psychoanalysts and consultants, indeed as human beings, to recognize that our lives are based on a hidden bed of ultimate, absolute, yet unknowable truth. A truth which we can only intimate, but never know. He encourages us, however, to strive to become it, thereby validating and enriching our lives and the lives of those with whom we come in contact with a modicum more of emotional truth, the milk, as he calls it, upon which the psyche grows and flourishes, even in the face of death itself.
Decided it's a bit short time to have, as we used to have more time for the bus groups, but still we think for 5 minutes that you just gather around the tables and then we take it into the panel afterwards. So please make the bus groups for 5 minutes. You make ready for having the plenary exchange. We have two people who are going around with the microphones, so that you can just make a sign and you will get a microphone.
Ross, I want to thank you for, I want to thank you, Ross. Hi, Ross. I want to thank you for a really magnificent and very moving paper. I'll tell you one thought I had at the beginning about the issue of O. There is a song by U2 called All That You Can't Leave Behind. And it's about the struggle to leave behind certain things. And there is a great line in it where the person, the singer, speaks of that which must be believed to be seen. And, you know, we tend to think of seeing as believing, but there are so many stories actually within science, certainly within psychotherapy, that require belief first and then seeing later. And that's an aspect, I think, of the second story, the second case. Whereas I thought maybe an aspect of the first case was the struggle to leave something behind. There was something being played out with the nursing staff, maybe about this patient's own mother, actually, that couldn't be left behind until some process happened. And it sounded to me like you had some thoughts about that. And in that context, I wanted to ask you, what was the thing you learned later that you didn't know at the beginning, and what is its significance?
You're very sharp, Jerry. I circumscribed it by saying it was the fact that the mother had died the previous year from the same illness. But what I felt I couldn't actually write, and I'll say in all confidence here, but I haven't published, although this paper has been published in Germany already, is that this tumor was not an abdominal one, but it wiped out all her sexual organs, and so did it of the mother. And there were thoughts that this was like the abortion of the child that she never had.
Thank you very much, Ross, for such a profound keynote. In the realm of the unknowable and unknown, today is the fourth anniversary of my partner's death, and your last lines were, he took that tricky path of living fully to the end, and it is a very tricky path. But what I want to ask you is, you mentioned something about the cruel nurses and that you discovered something about that later.
No, the business about what was discovered later was what I just said.
I
see what you're... When Mrs. Smith said, you know, sometimes the way they treat me, I feel like, you know, they're torturing me, they're mishandling me, then came out in the sessions with the team that she was right, that there was so much aggression and so much sadism involved in their reaction to her, that what she was feeling was correct.
And what was going on for you during all of that?
I don't know. Turmoil, thinking, what the hell am I doing here? Panic. But I suppose that's the theme. Some kind of faith that if we stuck to it, that something good would come of it, some truth would emerge. But I can tell you there were moments of darkness where I thought, I don't know what I'm doing here.
Thank you very much for one of the most eloquent presentations I've had the privilege to experience in ISPSO. I had to bounce in and out there, but I work in a setting of pediatric oncology, and so a lot of the things you were talking about resonated very much with me. And I don't know about O.
Nobody does.
Which I guess is a safe spot. But I guess the thing that was running through my mind is the working with adults and ourselves about death is one thing, and then take that and then think of the position of a parent whose child is dying and approaching death. And we were talking, and the thing that amazes me is, it's unbearable for all concerned, and some families really never recover, in a sense, but they embrace it. And that word, I guess what you did and what I've seen be effective is how with that, you can say it's a primary task, but that as what it is, how can you construct a holding environment to contain what is unbearably unknowable? And I think what you reported is points to how to do that in some ways.
Yesterday I told you that I felt that that what made the indigenous understand the way of working we had was oh. And you reinforced me, and I am very grateful and moved. And I really hope, what's next in terms of finding different narratives? So methodologically, what's next? But I'm really grateful because it's this individual, but it's also that depth of a way of life sometimes. What happens when a context can be erased? And I think in society that things are going to happen.
This will be the last comment, Jeanette.
Thank you, Ross. It was extremely moving, and our table used a lot of tissues. I think there was just one thing that really came through strongly for us, that it seemed to us it was all about love. And that was particularly so in the second case, how manifest that was.
I agree.
That's all I want to say.
I like to thank you for your contributions and sharing thoughts. And of course, Ross, I'd like to thank you for this presentation. And I'd just like to have very short reflections on my own when I was listening to you. When I have been listening throughout this week about the topic that has been on, you were linking very much to that too, the anxiety of the unknown, the anxiety about the future, the questions for which no one at the time has an answer, the anxiety as part of life, but I think also in your presentation you showed us that humor is part of life in the middle of the desperate situation, and the topic of nurturing persons, not just nurturing tasks, and that connection also talking about grief and mourning, and at least also hope. So with these words, I'd just like to thank you, and on behalf of ISBO, give you this present, and thank you very, very much.